I introduce you to Robert Tobin Singer.
Thank you. You know, most of the work that I do is not really standing in front of audiences lecturing as I am with you this afternoon. It's actually counseling Jewish people who, for numerous reasons, have found themselves within the clutches of cults and missionary groups throughout North America. But you know, you learn lessons every day. Today, this afternoon, when I arrived here, I learned a very important lesson. You know, when I pulled my car up here, I look at the synagogue, and I say, boy, they know how to welcome a rabbi. There's balloons in the front, with pink, with this color. I'm saying, this is a place. I come inside, I hear all kinds of music, I go in, I meet there a big, tall clown, a Langoluction. He's standing there right in front of me. Shh! They know how to welcome a rabbi here. Then I ask, do you know about the lecture? They don't know. It's a baby naming thing. So the caterer showed me that this is where I am here in the basement. Nidrik, down, low. They put me in my place. But it's not low, and it's wonderful to be here with you this afternoon. One of the questions that I'm asked over and over and over again is, how did a nice Jewish boy like you, right? She gave me a look now. From Borough Park, Brooklyn, right? How did you get involved in such an unusual kind of work as retrieving Jewish youth, especially youth, from the church? So I thought I would just take one moment out and just tell you a little bit about myself. This really began when I was a teenager. I come from a very traditional Jewish home. My father's a big beard, you know. And so naturally, Saturday night after the Shabbat is over, as a traditional family, we would finish off the Shabbat in a very traditional way. We went to Moshe Peking. You know where that is? On
the clothes.
The clothes. It's Moshe Peking's name. Very nice. That. Fortunately, it's great. She's going, what's the name? When I write it down, can we go there? I remember it was after dinner. Must have been 11 o'clock at night, and as we were approaching the corner of 5th Avenue and 40th Street, I noticed these three young fellows pasting up posters on each of the lampposts along 5th Avenue. I was a very curious teenager, so I immediately went over to see Vashtetzach, what does it say? And it read, come this Tuesday night at 8 o'clock to Jews for Jesus, and learn more about your Jewish Messiah. Naturally, I became very upset, and I did what some of you may have already done. I began to argue with them. Oh boy, we went back and forth, going absolutely nowhere. Every time I thought I brought up a great point, they would just move on to the next point. About 10 minutes of this, we were doing nothing, accomplishing nothing. This elderly Jewish man came out of the dark streets of New York. He came over to me without saying a word. He grabbed me by the arm. He schlepped me away from them. If you're not from New York, he pulled me away from them. And with a finger like this, he said to me, don't you argue with them. You don't know enough. If you want to do something tonight to fight the missionaries, what you can do is, why don't you follow them around? And as they paste up their posters, you schlep them down. Now, I was very insulted. I mean, I had gone to yeshiva all my life. These hilarious didn't even look Jewish. I should be relegated to some kind of blue-collar work like schlepping posters down. That's what I can do for my people to defend ourselves against the missionary. That's my major contribution, poster schlepping. And I walked away in a huff. I was very disjointed by the experience. The following summer, I visited the land of Israel for the very first time in my life. My uncle lives in a place that I think is the most beautiful place on earth. I think many of you will agree with me. The Jewish quarter, the old city of Jerusalem. When I arrived there, my uncle told me that, you know, just the Shabbat before I came there, he had a very unusual guest at his home, a minister of the gospel from Sweden. And when the minister left my uncle's home as a gift to him, he gave him a King James Bible, the red letter edition, no less, the one where all the words of the Lord are in red. And when I saw that, I told my uncle that's exactly what I wanted to read. I took it from him and I began to study it very, very carefully. I remember it was the following Wednesday. I was praying at the Western Wall. You could see it from my uncle's kitchen. And I'm davening there, I'm praying there, I'm feeling very, very spiritual. It's an extraordinary experience for me being there, you know how it is. And suddenly, as I'm praying there, I feel a tap on my shoulder. I turn around, there's this nice-looking gentleman standing in front of me with a yarmulke on his head, you know, the cardboard one with the staple in it. They come give you when they go down the ramp, they have it in the box garden. And he looked at me and he said, "Excuse me, do you know the Lord?" I said, "Of course I do. I went to yeshiva." And he said, he had this very confused look on his face. He said, "You mean you know who Yeshua is?" And I said, "Of course I do. I went to yeshiva with him. He was in my class." We realized, he looked at me, I gave him another look, and we realized we were having a cross-cultural problem here. But I blew the rest of my vacation on him. We came back to the New York area, which we're both from, and we continued to study together, and I'm very happy to say I'm very proud of him. He lives now in Muncie, New York. He had, oh, the most delicious five kinderlach. He won't eat in my house. All right, so he won't. I think a good place for us to begin this afternoon is to take a look at who the missionaries are. The word missionary for us as Jewish people is a very, very, it's a charged word. When we as a Jewish community think of missionaries, what do we think of? We think of organizations. We think of places that we can point to. You see that group there on Queens Boulevard? You see that place there on 31st Street? They are the missionaries. And that's one of the most serious mistakes that we make. We think that way, by the way, because Jewish people tend to think organizationally, bureaucratically. When we think of missionaries, we want to think of an organization which has secretaries and typewriters and mailing lists and so on. That's a very, very serious mistake. Just to illustrate this to you, I was asked to lecture at a large university in Ohio, and not on this topic, but on another topic of theology. And in my conversation with the dean there, who was asking me to come there as a guest lecturer, he said to me, you know, we were talking about the work that I do, and he said to me, "Rabbi Singer, I just want to assure you that we don't have a missionary problem here at this university." And I asked him, "Really? How do you know that?" And he said, "Well, I remember a number of years ago, indeed, we used to have missionaries that would come to our campus, go especially to the Student Union building. They would have tables set up with literature there using and abusing Jewish symbols. We don't see that here any longer." And I asked him a very simple question. I asked him, "Tell me something. Are there any fundamentalist, evangelical, born-again Christians on your campus?" And he said, "What, are you kidding? This is the Midwest. We're packed with them." And I immediately told him that indeed you have a very serious missionary problem. Because in reality, any fundamentalist, evangelical, born-again Christian is completely dedicated to and obsessed with converting every Jew to Christianity. Before I move on with this afternoon's program, I just want to take out one moment so that we understand what I am referring to here. Sometimes Jewish people look at the Christian world as a monolithic group of people who essentially believe the same thing. And that's actually a very serious mistake. So very briefly, I want to take a look at the Christian world with you so that we know who I'm referring to and also who I'm not referring to. Now, one segment of the Christian world, especially here in the New York area, of course, is the Catholic community. It's important that every one of you know that the Catholic Church today and Catholics in general are not at all interested in converting Jews. In general, you will find that the Catholics you will meet will be most respectful of what you believe. They will almost never try to convert you. I know that if I go to a hospital to visit a patient of mine, I do not have to worry that the priest is going to try to convert my patient. That will never happen. On the contrary, he's someone I can approach to find a kosher meal where I can daven mincha. I mean, this is not a person who's going to try to... Another segment of the Christian world is, of course, the Protestant community. And you know, whenever we talk about Protestants in this country, we're talking about most of Americana. And I'm going to overgeneralize with you, and I'm going to divide up the Protestant community into two segments. One segment is your mainline liberal Protestant, the people many of you grew up with, your Methodist, Episcopalian, Presbyterian, Unitarian. These people are not at all interested in converting Jews. The people that we're going to be speaking about this afternoon are what we call the Christian right. The evangelical, fundamentalist, born-again Christians, these are the people that are completely committed to and obsessed with converting the Jews to Christianity. You might as well know it now. In the United States, there are more than 200 messianic synagogues. There are 469 Christian missions just to the Jews in America. Last year, $171 million was spent in this country on Jewish evangelism. And the estimate is in North America that approximately 200,000 American and Canadian Jews who have joined the ranks of these groups. Whenever we talk about Jewish evangelism, there are two rules you always want to keep in mind. Rule number one is that the person that will succeed in that initial contact with a Jew is almost always a Gentile evangelical Christian. It is almost never a Jewish person who has already converted. Rule number two, it's almost never a professional missionary. It's almost never someone who is on the staff of a mission to the Jews. In almost all cases, it's a layperson. It will be your child, your grandchild's roommate in college, God forbid. It will be someone they'll meet on the basketball court, in the cafeteria. It may be someone that you're going to meet at work, the accountant, the secretary, the bookkeeper. These are the people that are completely committed to converting the Jewish people to Christianity and are succeeding. The question is, of course, immediately is, how serious a problem are they? How many of these evangelical born-again Christians are there in the United States? Well, Gallup and Harris, a number of years ago, did a survey and they found that in this country, there are between 50 to 55 million Americans that identify as an evangelical born-again Christian. That's about one out of every five Americans. That's part of that army of lay Gentile fundamentalist Christians that want to bring our community, our children, to the cross. We become obsessed with Jews for Jesus, with these groups. We must understand it is the non-Jewish population within the evangelical church that's really making it all happen. Naturally, the question that immediately comes to mind is, how, you know, I mean, why? Why? Why are these groups so consumed with the Jewish people? I mean, what's the big obsession with the Jews? I mean, you have all heard of a group called Jews for Jesus, right? We'll be speaking about them a little later on this afternoon. Have you ever heard of a group called Baha'is for Jesus, Puerto Ricans for Jesus, Blacks for Jesus? No, these are groups we have never heard of. But we have all heard of a group called Jews for Jesus. What is it with the Jews? Why are they so obsessed with the Jewish people? Why is it so important for the church? And why has it always consistently been so important to the church to evangelize the Jewish people more than any other? Now, it's important to remember that evangelical Christians don't want to just convert the Jews, they want to convert the world. Sometimes I'm lecturing, people say to me, Rabbi, I go to football games. You watch football games, your husbands. You watch football games, right? I go to football games, baseball games, right? The people there, they hold up these huge signs. John 3:16. Rabbi, what does it say? What does it say in John 3:16? They have, I don't want to depress anyone, but the World Series 2 years ago, they had behind the catcher a guy there with a big oak tag sign, John 3, chapter 3, verse 16. Rabbi, why is this verse so important? That's all they have on the sign. Why? And they have special season tickets where they know the cameras are zooming in on. You know, what does it say there in John 3:16? Why is this verse so important? Well, it says there that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son so that anyone who would believe in him would not perish but have everlasting life. Well, you don't have to be a brain surgeon. You don't have to be a Talmudic scholar to deduce from that statement that if you don't believe in him, everlasting life is something you're not going to have. Perishing, that's going to be something you're going to be doing a lot of. I don't mean you personally. She winced at me. Just for the lecture, this is just a fact. Evangelical Christians want to save the world, not just the Jews. Yet we have always seen this unique obsession with the Jewish people. I live, too, in Muncie, New York. Muncie, Rockland County, sits above the state of New Jersey. The Bergen Record, the most prominent newspaper in Bergen County, that northernmost county in the Garden State, did a front page interview with two women that opened up a beauty parlor in Fairlawn, New Jersey, and the name of the beauty parlor is called, appropriately, Heavenly Touch. And they asked the women, why did you come here to Fairlawn, New Jersey to open up this beauty parlor? And the women were very candid. They said, we know that Fairlawn, New Jersey has a very large Jewish community, and we're here to share the good news of Christ with them. What does that mean? What does that statement mean? There was a study done, those of you who have family in college campuses, I want you to listen very, very carefully. There was an informal study done a number of years ago. They wanted to find out what sort of religious groups were coming to the finest universities in this country. They were studying the top 50 universities in the United States. And they found at these fine institutions, there were first of all 5.7 Christian groups that were coming there for the student body in general. You'll have groups like Campus Crusaders for Christ, InterVarsity, and so on. You will also have 2.2 Jewish groups. You'll have a Hillel at every one of them and a Chabad that will be there at every one of these campuses. You'll also have some other Jewish group that'll come around once in a while. The same study found that these same fine universities, there were 10.7 Christian groups that were there specifically targeting the Jewish students for conversion. What does that mean? I was speaking in Nashville at the West End Synagogue over there, and after my lecture and after we took the questions from the audience, so everyone, you know, the lecture ended, and this fellow came over to me. He introduced himself. He's the pastor at a church not far from where I was speaking, and he said to me, Rabbi, I just want you to know, I would rather convert one Jew than 50,000 Gentiles. What does that statement mean? What is the obsession with the Jewish people all about? Why us more than any other? And this afternoon, I'd like to offer a number of reasons for this. The first reason is that the New Testament prioritizes Jews for conversion. In the book of Matthew, chapter 10, verse 5, when Jesus is instructing and warning his apostles, he says to them, go not into the way of the Gentiles, and the city of the Samaritans, enter not, only go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. In the book of Romans, chapter 1, verse 16, when Paul echoes that sentiment when he says, to the Jew first, and then to the Greek, or then to the Gentile. What you find in the New Testament, this unique obsession with the Jews, almost to the exclusion of Gentiles. We even find in Matthew 15 and Mark 7, Jesus refuses to heal a non-Jewish woman's daughter because she wasn't Jewish. He refers to her as a dog. He says, it is not right for the children's bread. You know, it's not right to give the children's bread to dogs. And the woman says, but even dogs eat from the crumbs that fall from the master's table. And Jesus says, now, woman, I see that you have great faith, and agrees to heal the daughter. We find in the New Testament this enormous emphasis on Jews, almost to the exclusion of Gentiles. But ladies and gentlemen, there is a second reason for this that is even more important for us, especially today. And that is that evangelical Christians are consumed with the subject called eschatology, which means the study of the end times. These evangelical Christians want to know what's going to happen at the end of days in the messianic age. Our Bible describes that at the end of days, the nations of the world will come and attack Israel over the status of Jerusalem. These evangelical Christians want to know, who are these nations? Are we living in that time? What does that have to do with what we're talking about here this afternoon? Well, in the book of Matthew, chapter 23, verse 39, Jesus makes a very important statement. He says, I will not return until you say, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. Because when Jesus made that statement, he was speaking before a Jewish audience. The church has always understood it to mean only one thing. What Jesus was actually saying is, I cannot make my second coming until the Jewish people are converted to Christianity. Evangelical Christians believe that this is the time. Jesus should be making his second coming in around 5 years from now, around the year 2000. And therefore the Jews must be converted before then in order to enable Jesus to return. Ladies and gentlemen, you are holding up the show. As a matter of fact, if we go back in church history, back to the year 1000, there was also then this enormous anticipation that Jesus was going to make his second coming at that time. And right before the first millennium, just like today, we have this tremendous push to convert the Jews, different techniques, but it's tremendous push to convert the Jews. Well, we know the year 1000 came and went, and Jesus never showed. The church understood full well that it was because of the Jews, because they refused to accept him as their Lord and Savior. That's why the kingdom of heaven did not arrive. Unspeakable atrocities against our people resulted. Here comes the year 2000. A group called, a denomination we'll be speaking about a little later on, called the Assemblies of God, actually has a program called Harvest the Year 2000, where they want to harvest the Jewish people for Jesus before then in order to enable Jesus to return. There's a third reason for this, and the third reason may be the most important one, and that is, it's a very simple psychological reason. Jesus was what? He was a Jew. And he claimed that he was the Messiah. The idea of a Messiah is exclusively a Jewish one. The notion that a man would come at the end of days and usher in a utopian society of peace, world peace, universal knowledge of God, that's only Jewish. If you studied all the other religions that existed throughout the Roman Empire, you wouldn't find another one which had such a concept. The question then becomes, who should have then believed in him? If indeed Jesus was the Messiah, who should have accepted him? Obviously the Jews. They were the ones who were anticipating the coming of a Messiah. They should have been the ones to accept him. Except there's one problem. The Jewish people were the one nation that said, we wish he was the Messiah, but unfortunately he is not. And that has always been a troubling reality to the church. And therefore it is only a conversion of a Jew to Christianity that can lend any credibility to the cross. Never the conversion of a Gentile. As a matter of fact, if you think about it, virtually all world religions somehow incorporate Jesus somehow. Islam, Jesus may not be the Son of God, he may not be part of the Godhead, but he is a prophet, he's a somebody, he's a something. Hinduism, Buddhism, he's a somebody. It's only Judaism, the very crucible that he emerged from, not only isn't he a positive force, but in all of our literature, he's not even a neutral force. The Jewish people? Many Christians would argue with what I just said. This is an unusual opportunity for me where usually my audience are almost split halfway between Jews and Christians in my audience. And when I'm speaking, sometimes I will see Christians, they're sitting there and they're nodding their head like this. They're unhappy with what I just said. What's the problem? They'll say to you, hey, isn't it true that the first believers in Jesus were Jewish? They would disagree. They'd say, right, isn't it true that all the apostles, weren't they all Jewish, right? Almost all of the writers of the New Testament, all Jewish, right? With the one exception of Luke, the Gentile physician. I always found that odd. The one non-Jew in the New Testament is a doctor. You ever never figured that one out, right? Oh, so we see that the first believers in Jesus were Jewish, right? But whom should they have been? Listen to me carefully. Evangelical Christians will tell your children, will tell your grandchildren, that if you would just look in your own Bible, Jesus is there. I can prove to you that Jesus is the Messiah from what they call the Old Testament. He's in your Bible. He's bouncing off every page. Well, if that is really the case, then who should have been these first Jewish believers in Jesus? Should they have been our sages, our rabbis, those who are most familiar with this sacred text of the Jewish scriptures, or our laity, those who knew least about what the Bible had to say about the Messiah? Obviously, there should have been some sort of correlation between the more you knew about what the Jewish scriptures had to say about the job description of the Messiah, the more likely you were to believe in Jesus, if indeed he was. Yet who were these first believers in Jesus? Tax collectors, prostitutes, hardly those people of our intellectual elite. This has always been a troubling reality to the church. If we look back in world history, it would probably be quite difficult for any one of us to imagine a program that has been a greater and more miserable failure than the effort to convert the Jews in the past. I mean, the Jews have always been very, very small in number. We've never been a people that have had numerous, that was never part of the statistics of our nation. The Jews have been persecuted in every country they lived in, with the exception of the one we're in right now. If you open up an Encyclopedia Judaica on any city in Europe, what is the history of that city going to be? When the Jews were slaughtered there, when they were exiled from there? The Jews, they couldn't convert. Remember that Europe converted almost overnight. I mean, the church, the Jews were the one people they just couldn't get, you know. To compress this problem, historians tell us that in order for a people to coalesce together and become a nation, there are many things they might have in common. However, historians tell us in order for a people to come together and to bond together and become a nation, they must have at least three things in common. Do any of you know what those three things are? Sorry? Language. They have to have a language in common. Okay, that's one. That's good. What else? They have to have a land in common. Very good. And one more, someone said it back there. History. Oh, all the chachamim we have here today. It's good. Land, language, and history. They may have many other things in common, but at the very least, they must have those three things. You know what? Let's take the Jewish people for one moment, and let's examine them under that set of criteria. You said land, right? Well, let's ask you, do the Jewish people have a land in common? I'll ask you, do the Jews have a land in common?
They did, yes.
Yes, yes.
You know, They taught me that when you lecture to Jewish audiences, you should always frame your questions in the yes or no format. This way you limit the possible responses to three. I don't know where we went with this. It's a very simple... That's a long one. I answered the Jewish people have a land in common. All right, let's do it this way. Those of you who said yes, we do, what land were you referring to?
Israel.
Oh, good. And those who said no, why did you say no? Why no? For the overwhelming majority of Jewish history, the Jewish people didn't live in the land of Israel. As a matter of fact, for the overwhelming majority of our history, the Jewish people never saw the land of Israel. Okay. Language, you said back there. Do the Jewish people have a language in common?
No.
I'm never going to make it by 2 o'clock. It's not going to happen. All right. I personally certify the Jewishness of this audience. You can marry into them. With everything, no question about it. Did the Jewish people ask them? Those of you who said we have a language in common, what language were you referring to? You can't even agree on this. And those who said no, why did you say no? For the majority of Jewish people, certainly didn't use Hebrew as a conversational language. All right, I mean, this one should be easy. Do the Jews have a history in common?
Yes and no.
That's sort of a tricky kind of question. I imagine all of you are Jewish people, or most of you Jewish people from the Northeast, from the New York area. What does your Jewish history have in common with the Jew who lives in Morocco? Well, not too much. If we go back around 2,000 years, we find a lot of commonality. Ladies and gentlemen, I submit to you, there is no other nation that has less of the land, language, and history in common than the Jews, yet we're the eternal nation. We're the ones they couldn't convert. In the past, the church has used many techniques to convert the Jews. Persecution. Our forefathers were offered the sword in one hand, the cross in the other, and they were told to kiss the cross, to kiss the sword. And they chose the sword overwhelmingly. Forced debates took place, particularly during the Middle Ages. Bribery and so on. Listen very, very carefully. Little more than a quarter of a century ago, fundamentalist Christian denominations came together and had two important conferences on the Jewish people in two very unlikely places. One of them was in Switzerland, and the second and more important one was in Thailand. At these two conferences, they literally put the Jews under a microscope. They wanted to understand what had the church been doing wrong up to this point, and what new techniques can be employed to finally evangelize the Jewish people before the year 2000. And they found that indeed the church had a number of unique problems with the Jews. The first problem they called it was a PR problem, a public relations problem. What was the problem? They realized that Jewish people tend to equate Christianity with persecution. For most Jewish people, we just hear the name Jesus Christ. You might as well be scratching your nails on a blackboard. It makes us uncomfortable. We don't want to hear this Jesus Christ. We don't want to hear it. We don't want to see it. We don't want to know about it, right? I'm sure maybe some of you have been to a church in your life, right? You go in there, right? Oh, we're not so happy in there. Let's get out of here. Let's get to the catering part. I'm not so interested. You know, you're sitting there over there, right? You're going, Sammy, that statue looked at me twice. I'm getting out. I don't know about you. I don't want to be here. I don't want. This is not for me. I don't want, you know. In general, Gentiles are very comfortable in synagogues. They're happy, oh, very nice. But we are very uncomfortable with Christian services. Christian icons don't conjure up warm, spiritual, affectionate feelings within our neshamas, within our souls. Oh no, we don't want to see it. I'm sure this morning when you got up Sunday morning, right, to get a paper dart and whatever you do there, right, and you hear the church bells flying in the background and the doors zetzing open, you're not saying, hold me back, Shmuel, I'm plotting to go in there. No, we don't want to go. We don't want to look. We don't want to see. Don't look. It's open. Don't, right? We're not interested. And that's why at these two conferences, these evangelical Christians came up with a way to deal with this problem, a technique. And the technique simply goes like this. You're Jewish? Oh, we love you. L-O-V-E. Love, 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 love. We love you. Do you know, we love you. That's right, love you. Love, love, love. We love you. L-O-V-E, love you. We love you. Did you know that we love you? We love you because you're chosen. You're the apple of God's eye. Boy, we love you. Persecution? Ho-ho-ho. Any Christian that persecuted a Jew in the name of Jesus couldn't possibly be a real Christian, because the Christian, the true Christian, just loves the Jew. We love you to death. We love you so much. Do you know that we support Israel? Oh, we support Israel. As a matter of fact, we support Israel like you don't. I mean, the Jewish community is very divided over issues like, should we be trading land, you know, for an agreement from these? Should we touch the hand of someone who kills innocent Jewish children? We're divided over this issue. Evangelical Christians believe that Israel shouldn't give up one inch for any piece of paper. They were against this whole Madrid business from the beginning. I remember when the Intifada began in Israel, Jewish groups were canceling their travel plans. The evangelical Christians were going there by the plane load. You might as well know it now. Only 45% of Americans, only 45% of Americans who visit the land of Israel annually are Jewish. The vast majority of them are Christians. They supported the exodus of what was then Soviet Jewry and Ethiopian Jewry. But just loving us up like this is not going to work. That alone, that technique alone couldn't possibly work. First of all, it was tried already. It was tried by a man named Luther, Martin Luther. In 1523, Luther writes an essay on the Jews. It's called Writings on the Jews, where he says, of course the Jews don't want to become Christians. We treat them like dogs. We don't treat them like human beings. What could we expect of them? He says, if I would be a Jew and seen such idiots and blockheads teaching the Christian faith, I would rather been a pig than a Christian. You know? And he says, we must treat them with love and kindly and love them. You know? And this way they'll come over to us. The year again is 1523. Why is that year so important? Because in 1543, Luther is now writing four books on the Jews. The most famous one is called The Jews and Their Lies. The opening verse starts like this: what then shall we Christians do with this damned, rejected race of Jews? And he goes on and he says, since they live among us and we know about their lying, blasphemy, and cursing, we cannot tolerate them unless we wish to share in these lies and cursing and blasphemy. We must not seek vengeance, for they are surely being punished 1,000 times more than we might wish them. Let me give you my honest advice. And he lists his advice. First, their synagogue should be set on fire. Whatever doesn't burn up should be covered over with dirt, so no one may ever see a cinder of it. And this ought to be done for the honor of God and Christianity, showing that we Christians have not tolerated such lying, cursing, and blasphemy. Their homes should likewise be set on fire, for they practice in their homes what they do in their synagogues. Rabbis publicly executed, their prayer books publicly burnt. What happened in 20 years to this man? What happened in these two decades? Yeah, Luther describes many, many interactions he had with the Jewish community during those two decades. He describes once going to a rabbi's house, not just any rabbi, a chief rabbi of a city in Germany. He thought that maybe if I can convert the rabbi to Christianity, maybe he could schlep along his balabatim, maybe he'll bring along some of his congregants with him. He describes going to the rabbi's house, spending the time with him, finally leaving the rabbi's house, slamming the door behind him, because not only was he unable to convert the rabbi to Christianity, the rabbi actually had the audacity, the chutzpah, to try to convert Luther to Judaism. Obviously, the church realized that just loving us wouldn't work. Just loving us would not get Jews to convert to Christianity, and they understood why. They realized that in reality, the real reason why Jews don't want to convert to Christianity, nothing to do with the love business. has to do with the fact that Jews simply don't want to convert to Christianity. They don't want to stop being Jewish. They don't want to convert to another religion. They don't want to become un-Jewish. Jewish people, even those who are not affiliated, even those who are not particularly observant, will tell you, look, I was born a Jew, I'll die a Jew. I don't want to convert to something else. And that's why at these two conferences, ladies and gentlemen, they developed a second technique that has been, as you understand by now, devastatingly successful against our people. A technique that deals with this very serious problem the church has with us. And the technique goes like this. When you're becoming a believer in Jesus, you're not converting to another religion. Oh, no. You're becoming a messianic Jew, a fulfilled Jew, a completed Jew. It's the most Jewish thing that you can do. I mean, Jesus was Jewish. The apostles were Jewish, right? How could it not be Jewish to believe in Jesus? I want to read a letter to you. Written by a man named Donald McGavran. He's downstairs already, but he was the dean of Fuller Theological Seminary. And he writes this letter to one of the leading missionaries to the Jews. His name is Phil Goble. He was what we call the grandfather of indigenous missions, meaning converting people in their own culture. Dear Phil, I am increasingly confident that messianic synagogues are the answer. It must be possible for Jews to become Christians while still remaining Jews and cherishing their Jewish ancestry. Swedish Americans cherish their Swedish ancestry. Chinese Americans cherish their Chinese ancestry. Hebrew Americans ought to cherish their Hebrew ancestry and remain strongly Jewish. They should proclaim, I'm a Jew. I go to synagogue. I invite you to my synagogue. It meets on Friday evening. Those who go there should be made to feel right at home. The singing should be led by a cantor. The men should wear little skull caps, and the Torah should be taken out of a cupboard as a big roll and laid on the pulpit. In short, Phil, every aspect of synagogue worship must be duplicated. I further think that it will be advisable for non-Jews to be encouraged to worship in congregations which met on Sunday. Let messianic synagogues be 100% Jewish. Let them never serve ham or bacon at their meals. For those of you who have never had the nachas, have never had the pleasure of seeing an inside of a messianic congregation, we have many of them here in the Queens, Long Island area, I want to give you an idea of what you're likely to see there when you go into one. First of all, you will never see a cross anywhere. They are not visible anywhere in the sanctuary. There are certainly no statues, no stained glass windows. On the contrary, in the front of the sanctuary, there's an Aron HaKodesh, a holy ark. In the center of the sanctuary, there's a bima with the Torah is read every Friday night. You will not have there a messianic pastor, a messianic priest. Oh, no. There's a messianic rabbi with a yarmulke on his head and tzitzis that adorn the sides of his trousers. Messianic Jews do not celebrate Christian holidays. Get that straight. They celebrate Jewish holidays, but they give it a Christological spin. I think I need to explain. They don't celebrate Christmas or Easter that's coming up. They're going to celebrate Passover, ladies and gentlemen. As a matter of fact, this is one of many, many messianic Passover Haggadahs. If you go to a messianic Seder, and they're all over the world, you look at the table, it's set up pretty much in the way your Seder table looks. Very traditional. But once you start to listen to the service, you realize there's something not quite right here. Oh yeah, you have the wine at their Seder, but they would tell you that the wine represents the blood of Jesus. And the matzah represents the body of Jesus. Do you know the reason? Listen carefully. Do you know? I bet you didn't know this. Do you know the real reason why Jews have three matzahs at the Seder to represent the Holy Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Do you know why the matzahs are perforated? They have holes in them? Because Jesus was perforated. Do you know why the matzahs have stripes going up and down? Because Jesus had stripes. Do you know why the middle matzah is broken? Because Jesus was broken. You know why the middle matzah is wrapped in a white shemata and a white towel? Because Jesus was wrapped in a white shroud. Do you know why that middle matzah is hidden beneath the Father? Because Jesus was hidden away in the tomb. Do you know why that matzah is brought back at the end of the Seder? Because Jesus will return.
Caller said that this morning on Religion on the Line.
Who's that?
The Messianic Movement has designed something called a communications card. What is this tool? It's an important tool to trade. Communications cards teach these Gentile, sometimes unsavvy, they don't know how to talk to a Jew, teaches them how to communicate with a Jew. This is it. Communications cards always have two columns. One column says, don't say, and the other column says, oh, so you guys are good. Let's go through some of these don't say's and do say's together, if you will, so we have an idea of what's going on over here. The first on the list of don't say is, don't say to a Jew, Jesus Christ. We don't want to hear Jesus Christ, that Jew's in oil. Instead say, Messiah Yeshua. That's nice. Don't say to a Jew, convert. Jews, they don't want to convert. Instead say, become a Messianic Jew. That's nice. Don't say Christian. We don't want to hear from Christians. Don't talk to Jews about Christians. They're not from Christians. They don't want to hear about that. Instead say, a Bible believer. That's nice. Don't say to a Jew, come to church. Jews don't want to go to church. They don't want to go to shul. How are you going to get them into a church, right? You can't get them Shabbos morning to shul on time. How are you going to get them into a church? You're sugared totally or partially, right? Don't say come to church. You can't get them in, right? Can't get them for a minion. Forget about it. Instead say, come to a meeting of Bible believers. That's nice. There you go. Thank you. Catching on here. Don't say the New Testament. Jews, they don't want to hear from New Testaments. We don't have it. Instead say, the New Covenant. That's nice. Oh, good, get you on. Don't call it a cross. We don't want to hear from crosses. We don't want to say a tree, a stake. That's nice. Well, what the new ones, this is very big. You go into a Messianic congregation, they're going to tell you, did you know that there are Orthodox rabbis that have accepted Yeshua? You didn't know? Oh, yeah. We know of Orthodox rabbis who became Messianic Jews. Who are they, you ask? Oh, no, we can't tell you because they live in Crown Heights and Williamsburg. If they tell anyone, they get their heads broken open. And I don't know if you've ever been to Crown Heights or why these people stay there. I have no idea. There was one such Orthodox rabbi right here that actually did become a Hebrew Christian, one of the leading missionaries to the Jews. His name is Michael Essies. He wrote a book called Michael, Why Do You Hate Me? He describes him there as being an Orthodox Jew, going to rabbinical college, being ordained, and finally accepting Yeshua. Michael Essies, Rabbi Michael Essies, made only one little mistake. What was his big mistake? He got divorced. Why is that such a big mistake? Because now his ex-wife decided to write another book. This is it. It's called Survivor of a Tarnished Ministry. And if you look on it, on page 71, she actually has a picture of his ordination paper. It's called the Sephardic Yeshiva of New York. You never heard of this rabbinical college? There's a good reason. It doesn't exist. If you go to the next page, page 72, she actually has a reprint of his instructions to the printer, telling the printer how to make up his ordination paper. The whole thing was a fraud. The names are changed to protect the guilty. I think I need to explain what that means. If you open up a Jews for Jesus newsletter, and you look at the names of the people there that signed the articles and so on, you'll probably not find the names, a group of names that are more stereotypically Jewish. Names like Itzkovitz, Matkovitz, Shmekovic, Lekovic, you know, it's like a Borough Park phone book, you know. I mean, my name is Singer. That name could sort of fly either way. No, that's not the kind of name you're going to hear there. As a matter of fact, the director for Jews for Jesus for the Los Angeles office, his name is Tuvia Zaretsky. It's a nice name, huh? A number of years ago, Tuvia Zaretsky was invited to come and be on a interview on a local cable television show in Philadelphia. Found out about it, immediately called the host. Said, look, if you want to spice up your show a little bit, ask Tuvia Zaretsky if that's his real name. I think the show is about 12 or 13 minutes in, and suddenly the host turns to Tuvia Zaretsky, he's very elegant, he says to him, excuse me, is Tuvia Zaretsky your parental given name? Very elegant, you know? So Tuvia, of course, I mean, I was very fortunate that morning because I was watching this on a really good color television, because this guy's face changed every color of the spectrum. He was hemming, he's hawing, he's falling off his seat, he's very uncomfortable with the question. The host saw he had something really juicy, so he's going with it, you know. He could see his Nielsen ratings going through the ceiling, you know. And finally, Tuvia Zaretsky admits and he says, no. Well, then obviously the $64,000 question is, well, Tuvia Zaretsky, what exactly is the name that you are? Lloyd Carson. Very briefly, very, very briefly, I want to go through the Christian denominations very quickly with you that actually are behind this and support this overwhelmingly. One group will come as no surprise to any one of you. It's a group, of course, called the Southern Baptists. They almost underwrite Jews for Jesus. Another group is called the Seventh-day Adventists. You ever hear Seventh-day Adventists? It came as a very big surprise to me. I always used to think they were just into health food. But actually, Boy, once you guys start clucking away, boy, it's not all right. You like this one, huh? They actually have a magazine called Shabbat Shalom, which they send out unsolicited all over the world. Ladies and gentlemen, look at the top front of it. Is there any way in the world to tell this is not Jewish? No way. It's front of it, Shabbat Shalom. Couldn't sound more Jewish than that. When I go to universities and I go into the Hillel, they always have a magazine rack, right? So I see what magazines they have there. So they always have their Moment magazine, Reform Judaism, and Shabbat Shalom, and Hadassah, all hanging right over there, you know, together. Another group, it's called the Lutheran Church. Not the whole Lutheran Church, but a part called the Missouri Synod. They support nearly 30 Messianic congregations in the United States. Another group will come as no surprise to you. I mentioned them earlier, the Assemblies of God, the fastest growing fundamentalist evangelical Christian denomination in the world, 16 million members worldwide. They support nearly 50 Messianic congregations in this country. As a matter of fact, the Assemblies of God Messianic Congregation on Coney Island Avenue in Brooklyn, actually, they have a special van designed to take people from the nursing homes in the wheelchairs and lift them up and bring them to the Messianic congregation there. It sits right in front of their congregation on Coney Island Avenue between J and K. The largest mission to the Jews in the world is a group you have all heard of. It's a group called Jews for Jesus. And I want to tell you a little bit about them. Jews for Jesus, their budget for last year was $11.9 million. They have offices in New York, 31st Street between Park and Lexington, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Boston, Detroit, Chicago, Miami, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, St. Petersburg, Moscow, Johannesburg, Buenos Aires. Jews for Jesus has a ministry for everyone. Jews for Jesus has a special ministry just for the elderly. A magazine I'm sure many of you have seen called Modern Maturity. I'm not saying that you're all senior. Modern Maturity, they the largest subscription of any magazine in the country. They did an article on this about a year ago on cults, and Jews for Jesus was prominent in the article. They will actually send special volunteers into nursing homes, homes for the aged, adolescent. They will find out who are the Jewish people there that are not being visited by their own families and send missionaries in to convert them in the twilight of their lives. You will see that on film in just one moment. Jews for Jesus has a special ministry just for the deaf. They will, for instance, go to Gallaudet College in Washington, RIT in Rochester, find out who are the Jewish students there, and contact them on their TTY machines or on the internet. Jews for Jesus has music ministries, many of them. They will come to a college campus of your child, grandchild. They will come with a bus, a full big bus. Instead of Greyhound, it'll say Jews for Jesus on it. They will unload an orchestra that will come onto the front lawn of a campus, and they will start playing Jewish music. Naturally, that's going to ignite the curiosity of students, particularly Jewish students. When they feel the crowd has grown large enough, they stop playing their music, they move out into the crowd, and they will try to get the student's name, address, and telephone number. Jews for Jesus calls that a contact. For them, that's the bread and butter of their ministry. But listen so carefully to me, what I'm about to tell you. The most important thing the Messianic movement does, the most important thing that a group like Jews for Jesus does, is not the tracts, the leaflets they hand out on the street corners that I'm sure you've all seen. They actually will go to churches. The most important thing to do is go into churches and teach these non-Jewish evangelical Christians how to evangelize the Jews. You see, these evangelical Christians have this bizarre notion about Jews, that Jews are all a bunch of Old Testament scholars. They're there to tell them the truth and the how. I'm going to ask you first, do we have about 17 minutes left? We do, so we can show the film and then I can finish up, okay? You are about to see a film. This film that you're about to view, I have to warn you about it, it was not produced by a Jewish organization. The film you're about to view was produced by Jews for Jesus. Arlene and I, well, Arlene particularly, I nudged her, but it's important for you to hear it from them. The film is called I'm Still Not Ashamed. It was produced in Chicago, and I think if you remember one thing in mind as you're viewing this film, and you'll understand why as you view it and listen to it, it was not intended to be viewed by Jewish eyes. This was film was produced with the intention that only the church, only non-Jewish viewers and listeners would get to enjoy it. What we'll do is I'm going to just roll this forward just a moment. The film's total time is 9 minutes. Those of you in the back, There's a whole row here. I don't think you'd want to miss this. If you'd like to, if you have difficulty. I would like to bring this afternoon's lecture to a full circle. There is one other part to this equation that we haven't examined. What are we doing wrong? Why are we so vulnerable? I'm sure this will come as a surprise to no one. If we were doing our job, they wouldn't even get one soul. What is the obsession? Why are we so vulnerable? What are we doing wrong? I told you that most of my lectures take place on college campuses. When I'm there and I have time to spend with the students, sometimes I give them a Jewish IQ test. I'll ask them questions like, tell me, what was Moses' mother's name? What was Jesus' mother's name? Oh yeah, they all know Jesus' mother's name is Mary. They have no idea. Name two books in the New Testament, I'll ask them, and name two books in the Talmud. Don't even tell me what's in it, just the names. Oh, they can name all the New Testament, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, no problem, all the Gospels. They have no idea even the names of the books in the Talmud. I received a phone call from a mother hysterically crying. She had just found a New Testament between her daughter's box spring and mattress. There's a terrible, terrible confrontation that followed. Terrible thing. She told me that if my daughter came home pregnant or high on drugs, I'd know how to deal with it. What in life could prepare me for this? I told her that in order for me to help your daughter, I have to meet with her. That's the only way I would have to meet with her. And the meeting was finally set up. It wasn't far from here in Great Neck, New York. That's where they live. Very fancy, schmancy place there in Kensington. You have to drive through two big marble pillars just to get in there. If you're from Brooklyn, it's very intimidating. I come to Great Neck. I always thought that Great Neck is a funny name, isn't it? You name a name of a city after a part of the body and you describe it. Great Neck, you know, they should have a place like Terrific Thighs and Marvelous Ankles, right? All right, whatever. They have terrific...
Little neck.
Little neck and fat toes. Anyways. I come there to the house, a big house, you know, that has its own zip code, you know, I come in there. Elizabeth greets me at the door. I come in, she immediately begins to tell me about her beliefs in Jesus. She went to Boston University and she told me that's where it happened. Her roommate was a born-again believer in Jesus. When the roommate met her, Elizabeth, and saw that she was Jewish by her Jewish star that adorned her neck, she immediately gave her one of these new covenants, gave her one of these New Testaments. Elizabeth told me she didn't read it just then, but it was a couple of weeks later. She was feeling lonely, a little depressed. She just broke up with a boyfriend. And she told me she opened up this New Testament tonight. She started to read it, and she suddenly came upon a verse in this Christian Bible, she said, that penetrated her heart in such a way, that penetrated her soul, that was so spiritual, she realized how holy it was, that she immediately knew that this New Testament had to be the living Word of God, had to be the heaven breathes, she called it, inspired. So naturally, I was a little curious. I asked her, Elizabeth, what verse did you read that was so moving, that was so penetrating, so wonderful, so marvelous? She said, Rabbi, please pass me the Bible. I'll show you. I'll read it to you. So I took the Bible that was on the kitchen table. I passed it to her. She took it, and she turned a few pages and said, I'd like to read it to you, Rabbi. And I said, go right ahead. And she lifts it up and she begins to read to me this verse in the New Testament. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your might.
Got a set of handy?
Let me tell you something. I'm sure every person in this room has some family that we're worried about. If I would not tell you this, I would be misleading you. The number one thing that you can do for your family to protect them against assimilation, especially these groups, is give them a Jewish day school education. I plead with you, I'm leaving here in a few minutes, I can get away with anything. Instead of leaving it over in your will, listen to me carefully, instead of leaving it over so that they're going to go to Aruba with it, there's a hindrance in Swansik, but don't be foolish. Tell your son, tell your daughter, I will pay for my grandchild's Jewish education. I will pay for it now. Listen to me. Listen to me. Listen to me. Jewish camps are a wonderful, wonderful thing too. Jewish camps work well because it's a 24-hour experience and they really get to live Judaism for a couple of months. Don't be foolish and leave it over. Tell your family now, I will pay. What an investment that will be. I will pay for my grandchild's, my nephew's, I will pay for their Jewish education now. Don't be foolish. Listen to me. You understand? You have to understand the Messianic movement, you know? They're not listed, these groups, they're not listed in the newspapers and in the phone book under churches. They're listed under synagogues. You understand? Some people ask me, they say to me, Rabbi, how can I then know? If they're listed on the synagogues, how can I tell the difference? I always tell them, there's usually a good way to tell. If it sounds a little too Jewish, then you know something's not right, right? You know, right? A regular synagogue is called Beth Shalom, Hillcrest Jewish. You know, I just came back from Dallas. The Messianic congregation there is called Baruch Hashem. You know, I mean, that usually is a giveaway. See, if you're down in Florida and you're looking for a synagogue and you see in the phone book a place called, you know, Kenina Hurry, you know it's not a good sign. Your children need to be ready for this. They need to prepare themselves. By the way, most Jews are not lost to Jews for Jesus. They're lost to Jews for nothing. This is the second largest drain of Jews. Oh, and the spirituality. You go into a Messianic, don't go, but if you went into a Messianic congregation, there are people there crying in their pews to Jesus. There are healings that are going on right in the aisles. Rabbi Riskin, who was the rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue, told a story of something that happened in his congregation on Kol Nidre night, Yom Kippur night, the holiest night of the year. Right in the middle of services, this elderly gentleman collapses in his seat and begins to weep bitterly. Naturally, the people around him were very concerned. They ran over to him. Sam, is everything okay? What's wrong? Why are you crying? Why are you so sad? And Sam looked up at them and said, it's a funny thing. I remember back in the Altaheim, I remember in Europe before the war, if you were in Shul Yom Kippur night and you weren't crying, people would come over to you and ask you, is everything okay? What's wrong? What has happened to us? Where have we gone? What's going on with us? This notion of having a personal relationship with God is a Jewish idea. We were the people that brought the idea of a one God to the world. It is us. We gave away the business. It's a great tragedy. Our children don't know what it means. For many Jewish people, for most Jewish people, I dare say, the only thing they really feel spiritual about, the only thing they really feel, you know, is Israel. Well, Israel, that's what they'll get upset about. That's what they'll rejoice about. What would happen if we didn't have Israel now? What would happen? You'd have nothing to your faith? I mean, what's going on here? So I tell you, it's very important, a Jewish day school, a Jewish camp, very, very important. The friendliness, the friendliness. You go into a Messianic congregation, go in there, you'll see, don't go, but if you went, I don't want anyone to get any crazy ideas. If you went in there and you're a new face, you have never been in there before, every single person will come over to you, they'll introduce themselves to you. How do you do? What's your name? What brings you here? Where do you live? Do you have a place to eat tonight? To sleep? You have a place to live? You have someone to marry? They're very, very friendly. Do you ever go into a synagogue you have never been to before? young couples do. It's called shul shopping. You ever do that? You ever go, right? Cousins bar mitzvah and who knows where, right? You go to a synagogue you've never been to before. What are the first four words you're going to hear? You're in my seat. I mean, that tells you something. That was a good one, huh? She liked the one. But in all seriousness, was it not Abraham? He was but one. He sat in his tent and waited for visitors to come.